Hello and welcome to The Stack. On this week's show, I speak with Will Grant on his new book, Populista, plus a new magazine of film and visual culture focused on black, brown and indigenous communities globally, and also a title which is all about mushrooms. Yes, indeed. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, we have two new titles in town, Sim and The Mushroom Magazines. But first, we have a leading Latin American foreign affairs journalist, Will Grant. Populista, the rise of Latin America's 21st century strongman, is the name of his fantastic new book. The book depicts some of the biggest, most colorful, and most controversial characters in Latin America, from Hugo Chavez to Evo Morales. Here is Will with more.
It's been a good couple of decades now that I first started getting interested and involved in working in Latin America. My kind of origins in it started at university in undergraduate days when I went to Central America for my undergraduate dissertation and just thought, you know, this is the part of the world for me. This is the place that I'm interested in. So moved to Spain for a while and perfected my Spanish after university and then did a master's in Latin American studies in London. And as I finished that, there was a sort of lowest rung of the ladder job going at the Spanish language service of the BBC. So I was essentially making coffees and printing scripts in the Spanish section of the BBC World Service. But that was really helpful. They were very generous to me and basically helped train me up as a producer, sent me out with a microphone, showed me how to produce radio shows, things like this. So yeah, from there, I just little by little within the BBC started moving upwards in the organization and eventually spent a year in Miami as the Latin America's editor, then I think 3 years in Venezuela under Hugo Chavez as correspondent. I've spent three or four years in Mexico as correspondent, and then the last six in Cuba, but with regular trips around the region. So it's been a sort of interesting journey, and it's taken in a lot of different places, a lot of different governments, political systems. I guess if there's one thread that ties them together, it is this sort of autocrat, totalitarian, particularly left-wing autocrat system of the sort of Chavez-Maduro mold, and of course in Cuba too.
Well, and it's interesting you mentioned this totalitarian. I mean, the cover of your book, of course, we have Hugo Chavez, and then, you know, right by his side, we have Jair Bolsonaro, also, you know, in some ways also quite authoritarian. And it's interesting, right, Will, that they are both, you know, from different political spectrums, but in strange ways, quite similar as well.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the cover has provoked quite a lot of debate and quite a lot of quite a big response. But I think that's, you know, done very deliberately by us and the publishers, Head of Zeus. I mean, what we're trying to do with that really is you know, not say these are two one and the same thing exactly, but definitely the book is an attempt at looking at the good, the bad, and the ugly of what is commonly known as the pink tide. So what I tried to do was look at a period which covers Hugo Chavez's arrival to power in 1999 and sort of ends around Fidel Castro's death in 2016. And bookend, you know, what is known as the pink tide, that's the swing to the left in Latin America during that period, because for me, it's sort of the most interesting political phenomenon in the Americas of the 21st century. So the idea was to sort of look at the good, the bad and the ugly that those men, and they were by and large men, not all men, but they certainly were in the countries that I was looking at, those leaders achieved. Now, there was good in there. I don't think anyone can deny that Lula mm-hmm. pulled millions out of poverty, Evo Morales too, Chavez as well, at least for a time. But of course, the legacy of a lot of what was achieved was brought down with the commodities price. You know, once the oil price, once the soya prices started dropping, suddenly it became a lot harder. And all of these criticisms that have been building up about some of these revolutions or at very least political movements were that they were very short term. And so while I'm not sort of saying that Bolsonaro is Chavez and Chavez is Bolsonaro, I think what we're trying to do is say, look, it, in a sense, when you have leader-driven, personality-driven politics, it creates a space for a Bolsonaro-type figure, a Chavez-type figure to enter, you know, with a lot of the similarities, you say, and we can talk about the similarities, but just, to, you know, one, it is that sort of almost evangelical nature of their followers. You know, there's this sense that the leader is the people and the people is the leader is a very important idea in populism. And it's one that's been used to great effect by both of those men.
Well, absolutely. And I do agree. I think as a Brazilian, I can also say that this tradition, you know, still continues. Like in Brazil, we have, as you know, so many political parties, but then they kind of lose their power a bit. You need a strong figure like Lula or even Jair Bolsonaro for some kind of to stand out. And I think that's the similarity of all those men that you did the research. But also, Will, I like the fact that, yes, all of them populistas, but still, I think every country has its different histories. I think from the men here, you see Hugo Chavez, Daniel Ortega and Fidel Castro, perhaps they were the ones who were more kind of authoritarian in the sense, like of the old times. Do you know what I mean? I think perhaps Lula, Morales, they had a different type of populism, less kind of military-esque, in my opinion. I mean, what do you think about their differences?
Yeah, I think you make a number of really good points there. The first is that part of the intention, or my intention of the book, was to show that there are key differences between these leaders and in that movement or that moment that was called the Pink Tide. The reason being is, as a correspondent and a reporter in BBC, I quite often felt that even, you know, very well educated and very well informed editors, and certainly all manner of audience members and so on, often sort of painted the whole movement as a monolith, that everybody was the same, you know, the left-wing leaders, the populist left of Latin America of that time. And I just felt that didn't do justice to the huge differences between Lula's movement and, as you say, Chavez, or the rebirth of Daniel Ortega from this figure from the 1970s and this sort of strange evangelical, you know, highly almost zealot type figure that has appeared in 2007. And you're right that some are much more militarized than others. Some are much more democratic than others. And Lula, to me, stands out as somebody who was very much driven by a democratic purpose. His, you know, his background was hugely different to those, some of the other men in there. You know, he came through from the trade union background and was part of a collective movement. He had a very different understanding to, say, Chavez, who was a military cadet and then eventually attempted a coup. Now, once you establish that those different paths led them to that point of becoming presidents, then you can see that the movements that they would be leading were also different, even though they may have had a lot in common, i.e. pulling the poor out of their circumstances. But I think, you know, the power itself is a thing that is a thread that runs through, you know, all of these leaders naturally. And what that power does to them and their movements is very, very interesting.
Well, and it's interesting, I mean, especially more kind of in the beginning of the noughties, the period covered here by the book, there was some sort of alignment, as you say, as we discuss here, the Pink Tide was not uniform, there were differences between countries, but there was kind of, you know, an alignment between countries, which is actually a little bit different at the moment, right, in Latin America, where there's a lot of kind of infighting between leaders. I mean, I'm even surprised that, you know, the leaders of Brazil and Argentina, you know, strong economic partners, but they don't even talk to each other. I think the region is, you know, it's quite difficult diplomatically at the moment compared to that period. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the legacy that I've been sort of trying to discuss in the book, that, you know, what was left, what the vision was that Chavez had was a sort of Bolivarian idea of a united America. And how far are we from that? Now, there was a brief moment there where you had, you know, left-wing and populist leaders, because there isn't a distinction to be made there. Although it is very hard to define what is a populist per se, and it is very controversial, of course. But anyway, there was a moment there that, as you say, that right from the southern tip of Patagonia, right the way through to, you know, the US-Mexico border, really, there were left-wing leaders. AMLO didn't come through at that particular moment, but it looked like he would in 2006. But round about 2005 to 2007, the region was very, very left and very, very united in certain ways. Now, the way that that crumbled and the way that that, you know, didn't last beyond its moment is interesting. And I think it has led to this patchwork, because when the promises, I think, of some of the social aims didn't reach fulfillment and the prices started dropping of the commodities on which these revolutions and popular movements were based, then delivering to the poor became tougher. There was corruption, particularly in the Brazilian example and the Venezuelan example and Odebrecht and so on and so forth. And the populaces and the electorates became very disenchantized very quickly. Disenchanted, I should say, and very disenfranchised again. Not that they were necessarily ever built to the point that they would have perhaps hoped to be. So that, I believe, has then led to this sort of situation where we see a very, very kind of fractured Latin America and a very dissipated. So you have extremely hard right living right next door to, you know, pretty radical left. And they will always now, particularly in this 21st century context and this very polarized world that we're living in, see the world so differently that they can't actually appreciate that there are quite a lot of similarities between the way they speak. But, you know, in a sense, there is a difference that they need to accentuate, even though a lot of what they're doing, a lot of how they're working, it isn't that far removed from each other.
And Will, how do you see, I mean, I know you're not a futurologist, but how do you see the new trends politically in Latin America? Do you see a return of this pink tide, or perhaps it would be difficult to have a pink tide when you still have a country, you know, like Venezuela, for example? I know that even some people in the left in Brazil, they don't want to be associated with it, but there's still some people in the Workers' Party that, you know, they congratulated now Maduro on the latest election. So there's quite a lot of fragmentation there for the left to be back in power in some of the other countries as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do think that things are cyclical. And what I hope I managed to do in the book was show that the pink tide didn't come from nowhere, that the pink tide was a reaction to circumstances that were military dictatorships, that were civilian governments who were completely craven to Washington's will, to put it in its context, you know. So show the similarities between the men, but show their differences and show their different historical contexts. That's been important to me. And if I've achieved anything in the book, I do hope I've managed to do that.
That was Will Grant there, author of Populista. The book is out now. And listeners, I gotta tell you, I love a good film magazine. And now there's a new addition to the newsstands. I'm very excited about this. It's Sing Magazine. The film and visual culture journal focuses on Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities. The title is from the team behind Black Star Film Festival. In the first issue, the stories vary from queer Black Brazilian cinema to an interview with renowned director Lulu Wang. I spoke to Mayori Carmel Holmes, editor of Sing Magazine.
My career has been back and forth between filmmaking and journalism and communications, you know, sort of as a graphic designer or working in PR or in communications for institutions. So it's definitely part of a long practice.
And, you know, I'm curious about why you chose the title Sing as well. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, initially I was just thinking about the sort of Rastafarian or Jamaican patois, you know, when someone understands you, they say seen. And I was thinking about the, you know, sort of double or triple entendre of that, in that, you know, we're working in film or in other sort of visual mediums, and these are objects that are seen or experiences that are viewed. And then also thinking about gaze and how often, particularly in the US context, and in, I think in a larger sort of Western context, filmmakers and artists of color are operating, you know, either against or outside of a white gaze or an assumed white gaze. And so what seeing or being seen means in that way. And so I just thought it was really delicious as a title to kind of like play with all of those things.
Oh, I love that. And it's interesting when you mention, you know, the gays, LGBT community as well, because one of my favorite stories I have to tell you, Mayori, because I'm from Brazil. I love that profile that, you know, Heitor Augusto did on queer black Brazilian cinema. That's something so interesting. And that shows, you know, even though I know you're based in the US, the magazine has quite an international spirit to it.
Yes. I mean, that's something that's been of interest to me for a really long time, in seeing stories about marginalized people in a global context. You know, I'm definitely someone who devoured as much as I could reading about, you know, third world solidarity movements and Pan-African movements and third cinema, and thinking about, you know, our struggles are all connected. And one of the things we've been doing with Black Star as a film festival, which, you know, is how we got to producing Scene, is really trying to keep the conversation as global as possible. I mean, it's definitely not comprehensive, but it's definitely a goal.
And, you know, you mentioned there Black Star Film Festival. First of all, tell us a little bit more about the festival and how did it work out this year because of the pandemic?
Yeah, so we've been doing the festival since 2012. I founded it and currently am the artistic director. And we have enjoyed, you know, really lovely growth, you know, since starting in 2012. And this year, of course, because of the pandemic, the festival was principally online. We used a platform called CineSend and basically kept to the same volume in terms of number of films and ancillary workshops and things like that. But we did spread it out. The festival has generally been 4 days, and we spread it out to 7 so that we could kind of have a little bit of breathing room, anticipating people's exhaustion of, you know, watching things online. But it was actually, I think, given the circumstances, it was fairly great. We took a lot of care to try to provide people with, you know, physical and in-person ephemera as much as we could. And we were able to have a small number of drive-in screenings.
Mayori, coming back, you know, to the magazine Scene as well, it's just really beautiful title. I wonder, when it comes to distribution, how are you planning to promote? Is it going to be through a website, or do you have perhaps some places that are going to sell the magazine as well?
Yeah, so we do have, I believe it's 5 or 6 shops that are selling it currently. We're hoping to expand. There's one that's based in Tokyo, and then the others are in the US. I believe it's LA, New York. I know one is in Philadelphia, but we're definitely trying to sell in more shops. And we're offering it online. It can be purchased on our website. And then we're working to get the digital copies, you know, up on JSTOR so folks in, you know, colleges can have access to it. And yeah, we're trying to make it available in as many, you know, ways as possible.
Mayori, you know, I presume you are, of course, a cinema fan as well. And there's a lot of kind of stories about cinema in the magazine. How did you find this year was for cinema? You know, of course, we know about the difficulties about cinemas closing down. But, you know, I'm talking more in terms of, you know, diversity and topics like this as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the diversity thing is always a challenging one for me, because it is often only focused on race. And that gets a little obnoxious for me. But I do think there have been lots of opportunities that have been made more available to folks this year. And my hope is that those opportunities continue to be available. You know, I hope that it's not just in reaction to the, you know, uprisings around George Floyd's murder and Breonna Taylor's murder, and, you know, so many of these corporations having internal reckonings. I really, really hope that it is something that's sustained into the future. But it's been wonderful to see so many filmmakers that I know over the past decade, really. I mean, it's not just this year. It's been a build over the last decade of people just getting more and more access, which is really great. But there's still so much work to do. You know, the thing that I think about often is that we're seeing more and more faces, but there's still so many more and so many kinds of stories to be told. But, you know, I loved that a film like Time, for instance, by Garrett Bradley, made it out this year, and would have been wonderful to see it in theaters, of course. But I'm so glad that it was released and that it's doing so well and that so many people have seen it. So.
And sorry that I'm giving a couple of previews to our listeners, but there are so many nice stories on the first issue. There's also an interview of Lulu Wang as well, which is a fantastic director, you know, and I think it was an amazing get as well from the magazine.
Yeah, we were really excited that she was down. I mean, I really loved her film from last year, and it was really exciting. I thought of Lulu and Heidi, who is a friend, to be in conversation, because there was something about Heidi had a film in 2016 called Namur, and Lulu's film, The Farewell. There's something in their story style that made me think about them. And I was really, I always loved Interview Magazine growing up, and I love having artists interview each other. And so that one was, that was a great, I was glad we were able to make that one happen. And then they actually repeated, they had a, they did a panel together for the festival. So we got to see them in person.
And Mary, I do have to mention as well the design of the magazine. I think it's incredibly well made. And even though I know it's the first issue, but it's one of those magazines that, you know, it, it feels like it's been around, if you know what I mean, in a good way. if that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We worked with a really talented designer named Jelson Lee Innocent, who currently lives in Oslo. He's from the States, and he lives in Oslo, and he's just really, really talented. And we talked about collaborating somehow on Black Star, and we started with asking him to work on the logo for the journal. And then we really had a great experience, and then asked him to, you know, work on the overall design for this first issue. And I mean, I couldn't be more pleased. I think his approach to the text, and I think the comprehensive way that he's sort of thinking about how the topics and filmmakers themselves were presented, it was just really incredible.
And when we'll be able to see, I know, you know, it's still too early to say, but when issue two will come out, do you have any idea how often the magazine will come out?
Right now we're going to do biannual. So the next one would come out in May. So it'll be roughly the two issues per year. So one in the fall and one in the spring. For now, I mean, we are just, you know, very small team. This is the second thing that we're doing in addition to the festival right now. We do have some other projects coming out, but we want to get a good rhythm. And I think it would be great if we eventually were to make it quarterly, but you know, it's an expensive production and we definitely need to make sure that there's an audience out there to sustain us.
That was Mayuri Carmel Holmes, editor of Scene Magazine. And finally on the show, another very interesting new title in the newsstand, The Mushroom Magazine, which is all about, you've guessed it, mushrooms. From the Transylvania Mushroom Festival to how you can treat miscarriage with mushrooms, the title is a delight. I spoke to Sukaina Powell from The Mushroom Magazine to tell me more about the title.
So the idea for the magazine is something that myself and a couple of the other editors, Martin Powell and Natasha Kenyon, have had for some time. We all come from a sort of strong mushroom background, either in the medicinal side or the foraging side, or in my case, interested in it from the environmental side. And we've wanted for quite some time to put together a publication that would be very accessible, but quite sort of well-researched and aesthetically beautiful, focusing on the whole world of fungi, because many of the publications that were, you know, we would read were quite sort of hobbyist and didn't have the same focus on the sort of cultural side or the environmental side, packaging everything together basically in a really good looking outer shell. So that was basically what prompted us to put this into action this year, was the sense that people would be really interested in it and it was the right time to finally get the project off the ground.
Well, and talking about projects for the magazine, you guys got involved with a couple of other projects, like, for example, you know, the Future of Hope Foundation. Can you explain the connection of that and the magazine?
Yeah, so the Future of Hope Foundation is an amazing organization in Zimbabwe who they teach orphans and women and whole communities, really. Now they're kind of branching out to create sustainable microeconomic ecosystems using mushroom growing, mushroom selling. All of the sort of waste products from agriculture can be turned into something incredibly useful and nutritious. Mushrooms and foraging have always been like a part of the Zimbabwean diet. And this amazing woman, Chido Guevara, whose whole life story is fantastic. I can't really sum it up right now, but she's sort of raised herself up using, from being an orphan, from being a very small child, using mushroom growing, and sort of found her way into training with, you know, very determined to know exactly how she could pull herself up out of her circumstances using mushrooms and is now an incredibly accomplished mycologist working on some amazing projects down there. So one of the things that we really wanted to do with the magazine was the profits from the magazine are going to be split differently per issue. They're going to go to charity partners, the first one being the Future of Hope and charities like that, where people are really making a difference in people's lives using mushrooms.
And what I find particularly fascinating about mushroom, I mean, the incredible variety. I mean, some people might say, oh, the mushroom, but, you know, they might not have enough topics for, you know, to a series of magazines. But actually, I do think you will, because, as you say, you know, there's new mushrooms that are being discovered recently. It is fascinating. I don't even know. I mean, I'm not expecting you to know, but how many types of mushroom are there in the world?
Oh, God, there's probably going on for millions. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm sure we haven't discovered all of them. And there's just thousands and thousands of varieties that are getting, you know, reclassified and rediscovered every day. There's even mushrooms that we thought were just one species are now turning out to be, you know, three or four species that we've just been lumping together sort of casually for hundreds of years, or understanding in a completely, you know, a slightly outdated way. So there's just a lot, that there's almost endless things to discuss around mushrooms, from the, like, they can be used to make leather goods, they can be used to make building materials, they can be used to, like, design networks for, like, AI and planting and seasonal harvests. And I think they're going to become increasingly important to the world in general because of their amazing sort of variety. So yeah, there's a lot of mushrooms and there's a lot to say about them.
Well, and there's a lot of interesting stories in the first issue as well. I mean, I particularly like the Transylvania mushroom camp. Again, something I had no idea it existed. Apparently it's the 21st annual kind of event. That's such a cool kind of fascinating why they do that in Transylvania as well. Really, really good and amazing pictures as well.
Yeah, so that's it's one of the interesting things about mushrooms is that it depends, the culture around mushrooms differs so much depending on which country you're in. Transylvania and Eastern and Central Europe in general have a much, well, actually Europe in general has a much, much stronger mushroom culture than we do in the UK. And in Transylvania especially, they've got a very, very strong foraging community. And normally the mushroom camp has a lot of experts coming to talk about, you know, ethnomycology and all sorts of quite advanced sort of research topics. Obviously, this year it was a little constrained due to COVID, but they have really, like, got a very long and ancient tradition of working with mushrooms and incorporating them into their lives. So that's also something we were really keen to bring into the magazine, was the international character of different people's relationship with mushrooms and different ways in which they're approached all over the world.
And Sukaina, I want to ask, I mean, how are you guys selling the magazine? Can people go and buy on your website? Will you have some stockists, you know, around the world or something?
So right now, because we literally just launched, it's just available on our website. We're working on getting it out to stockists and some sort of independent bookshops and magazine shops in the UK and in America. But right now we have worldwide shipping organized through our own website, which is themushroom.pub. And you can buy subscriptions or single issues. So we're currently mainly just selling online at the moment.
That was Sukaina Powell from The Mushroom. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hall. And if you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fpandmonaco.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen to it again at monaco.com or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud. And before we go, a little song for you. Gilberto Gil with The Three Mushrooms. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time. It's goodbye from me.
The last mushroom, the last mushroom. Oh yeah, oh yeah.